Hello and welcome back to another episode of Open Floor. I'm Andrew Sharp, and on the other line, Ben Golliver. What's up, man?
Not too much, Andrew. Feeling very thankful this week, obviously with the holiday and of course with my big comeback on Instagram after last week. I'm sure we can get to that a little bit later. You know, you and I, shameless plug alert, did a crossover podcast with the guys from Light Years. It's a Warriors-centric podcast, Sam and Andy. They're great. During that podcast, I brought up the Clippers collapse, and I could hear you squeal. So any listeners who want to hear Andrew squeal, go back and listen to that podcast. You squealed because you couldn't wait to get the I told you so out. You had predicted this Clippers collapse. They've lost 9 games straight heading into Wednesday nights, their longest losing streak since 2010. And you're ready to bury them, aren't you?
I wouldn't say bury them. I also am not going to take full credit because I thought that the Clippers collapse was going to come closer to mid-December and it would be like a really dark December and January. But it's happened earlier than anyone expected. And so we should just get into the questions here. First, I will say apologies for not releasing this podcast on Tuesday. We had some Thanksgiving scheduling mix-ups, but we are going to have this podcast and then another podcast on Friday. So it should be fun. But we should talk Clippers because we've ignored this team for the better part of the last month. And things are getting pretty dicey. So Colin says, I just saw that on Monday night, Doc played injury-prone Blake Griffin 46 minutes in a game that the Clippers lost by 22 points, in which they were down 15 after the third. How hot is his seat? Now, Ben, you corrected me just before we went on this podcast and said that it turns out Doc played Blake Griffin only 33 minutes. But I think it's notable that I read this email and it was completely plausible to me that Doc would have played Blake 46 minutes because it just seems like the wheels are coming off in LA. So what have you been seeing?
Well, I think that is very telling because not only has the loss of Chris Paul totally changed their franchise in terms of their ability to win games, I think it's really changed their watchability too, hasn't it? I mean, I think to a certain degree they were always hated on when they get into these national TV games because they whined at the officials, you know, they do this and that. But they usually made up for it to me. I mean, the offense was always one of the league's most efficient. To me, they were still a fun team to watch. You know, Chris is a fantastic player. Blake's a fantastic player. Maybe it's not a perfect combination, but you still tune in. I got to be honest, these guys are tough to even watch at this point, Andrew. I mean, I turned on the Knicks game the other night. It's so flat. I mean, they look like a team that has given up on each other at some points. You know, I think part of it is there's a lot of injuries there to key guys, point guards, Gallinari, and that's put these players who are just, you know, well below average NBA players into much bigger roles than they can handle. There's not a lot of collective belief there. And it's strange because they started, 4-0? And people were writing the Clippers are trying to move on to the next chapter columns. And now it just looks like dynamite time.
Yeah, and so I feel vindicated, A, because I sort of predicted this, but more so because even during the preseason, you had these basketball hipsters coming out of the woodwork to claim that the Clippers were going to be so much more fun without Chris Paul and that Blake was going to be free and they were just going to be like the most exciting team in the NBA or in that mix. Like they were talked about as if this was going to be a top five league pass team. And to me, I've always loved Chris Paul. I always thought he got sort of a raw deal with those Clippers teams. And the Lob City Clippers, we've talked about it a lot this year. Some of these teams that are all in the West are sort of collapsing under the weight of expectations and because they can't live up to some of the impossible standards that like the Warriors set. And before the Warriors, it was the Spurs. And the Clippers were one of the original teams that we saw that happen to because it wasn't so much that they weren't exciting. It's just we knew they didn't have enough. And so it was painful to watch them just sort of grind out seasons that we knew were going to end badly. But That aside,
this is even more painful, though. Don't you think this is even more painful, what they're doing right now?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. This you take Chris Paul off the roster, and you appreciate how good he was, and that it's not easy to just sort of reflexively win 55 games every year. But I do think that the Clippers are now interesting for another reason, because there are dominoes left to fall here, whether it's a DeAndre trade, whether it's a Doc Rivers firing, or like if they continue to go this route, they're not going to have many other options but to start to think about tanking.
Yeah, I don't think it's too early to have that talk. I mean, you mentioned the Chris factor. I don't know if you saw, I tweeted this. When he was on the court during his Clippers tenure, so that's like 6 years, they never lost more than four consecutive games. I mean, that's, you know, he would always find a way, any slump, to kind of pull them out of it. So I think the big takeaway from the Clippers start to me is really the value of Chris Paul as a stabilizing figure. Yes, he's not good enough to beat the Warriors, but this is one heck of a player, all-timer. In terms of their depth, though, I mean, we came into the season saying, look, if everybody has perfect health, you know, Doc could be in a situation where he's playing like 9 or 10 guys and this could really work out. But I remember we put an asterisk on that. We said, look, Blake, Patrick Beverley, and Gallinari all missed time. So that depth is going to be stretched very quickly. And that's exactly what's happened. I mean, Gallo's out. Beverley missed some time. Now, Austin Rivers, I mean, he's shooting 36% from the field, and he's their second leading, or I think maybe third leading scorer. I mean, that is a tough look. All these other guys, I mean, a lot of these no-namers, Juwan Evans, they're getting rotation minutes now. You go right down the line. And so, to me, I'm not sure this is the team that Doc thought he would have. And when you listen to his comments, he's just blaming injuries. I'm not sure how long that will last with this group, given that he's assembled it. And given that the next man up, you know, those second string guys he's trying to turn to, just don't have anything. You know, and I was bagging on Wes Johnson on the last podcast. I mean, that's a Doc move. You know, Austin Rivers, that's a Doc move. And I think if you're the ownership, you're looking at him and saying, look, this is your mess. We got to move on from you. So I think that's the first button to push.
Well, I will say I loved Juwan Evans at Oklahoma State, and I'm pumped that he's seeing minutes, but it's a bad sign for the Clippers that he's seeing minutes.
Well, I'll be pumped when he gets above 31.7% shooting from the field, okay?
Yeah. Well, everyone on the team is in the 30s right now. Yep. I mean, Blake has not cracked 40% in like 2 weeks. Yep. So it's rough for him too. It's not just the guards. I mean, obviously Austin Rivers, if he's going to take 15 or 20 shots a game, you're in trouble. The Doc side of it, though, even last year, even this summer, I was out in LA for a little while back in May, and you talk to people, the things you heard about Doc's relationship to the Clippers were not, like, it was not good. Nobody really liked him even last year, and it's kind of shocking to me that they brought him back. And it's one of the things that we've seen over the last 5 or 6 years is that one of the biggest mistakes teams can make is not firing a coach at the right time. Like if you go back to the Wizards with Randy Whitman, or the flip side of this story is the Warriors firing Mark Jackson when it was clear that he wasn't the guy. And I feel like with the Clippers, it was pretty clear to everyone that he was not the guy to sort of lead this next era, and yet they brought him back. And that's another hurdle that they're going to have to deal with over the next month or so.
Yeah, and I understood it because, remember, he's making a lot of money because he had those dual roles before. So it's not like they strip him of his title.
The Clippers are worth $2 billion. Hey. You can fire the coach, and Steve Ballmer can eat that salary.
Well, I think they're going to fire the coach, but I can understand why in that situation they would say, look, it's a transition, bring him back, give him a shot, see how well he does. We can always fire him midseason, right? Like, don't you think that was their mentality? And also, like, if you tried to take a clean slate approach and just say, okay, we lose Chris, so we're just going to get rid of Doc, try to start something completely new, I think then you risk having that new coach tainted if they started slow like they have, right? Like, if let's say you put Sam Cassell into that spot and you say, okay, we're gonna give you this job, and then they go on a 9-game losing streak here because two guys get injured. Well, now all of a sudden you've kind of set him up for failure. To me, I think you let it get bleak, and then you pray for the midseason turnaround, and I don't think, by the way, you mentioned tanking. This playoff race is getting away from them already, right? I mean, I think that's one thing where if you're ownership, once you make that decision in your mind, like, we can't get back into it, and I don't think it's that far away, to be honest, given kind of the quality, but also just like the packed nature of that middle tier in the Western Conference, I don't think that decision's that much far away, and I think ultimately that's when you pull the plug.
Okay, so you were the first person to bring up Clippers tanking last night when we talked, and it got me thinking, because so before we get into the rest of the mail today, I do have a question here, because if the Clippers did tank, I don't think it would make sense with Blake's timeline, and yet Blake is making so much money, and he's got the sketchy injury history. Like, he's not the easiest guy to trade. Same deal with DeAndre, by the way, because he's due a lot of money this summer, so teams aren't going to want to give up a whole lot of assets for him. So I started thinking, who is the first Supermax player to get traded? And I'm working with a looser definition of Supermax here, because there have only been a couple true Supermax deals. Russell Westbrook, John Wall, Blake is in that mix. Mike Conley from a couple years ago. But I'd also would include like Andrew Wiggins, Otto Porter, Kyle Lowry, basically anyone who's making more than $25 million a year is who I'm talking about in this conversation.
Yeah, so real quick on DeAndre Jordan, I think he's fairly tradable. Look at like the Serge Ibaka example from last year. You're not going to get a great return in that situation. Everyone knows he's on that expiring contract and is going to be due a big amount. But you can get something if you really do pursue the rebuild. In terms of these Supermax guys, the names that you listed, it's hilarious because so many of them are like so woven into the fabric of their franchises. Like, you know, John Wall, Mr. DC, you know, Oklahoma City and Russell Westbrook, like that's one and the same. I mean, Lee Jenkins is Blake Griffin's story. Weren't they just about to like lift his jersey up into the rafters and retire it during the middle of his career because he's Mr. Clipper? And now we have to spin around and think about him getting traded. Of all the guys that you named, Kyle Lowry be the one who I would be the most expecting to see moved, partly because Toronto has just de-emphasized his importance with their new approach, and partly because he's on a shorter-term contract. He's not on that super long-term deal like these other guys. But
that's the thing.
I think
Lowry only has, what, 2 years after this?
Yeah, I think he signed a three-year, something like 3 years, 100 or something like that. But are you just trying to start the Blake Griffin trade rumors? Is that what this is about?
No, I think it's an interesting question, though, because a lot of these guys would make sense. Like, and maybe not. I don't want to trade John Wall, and I don't think that the Thunder would trade Russell Westbrook under any circumstances, because he sort of keeps them relevant regardless. But like a Mike Conley is already someone you should, the Memphis would think about trading if all things were equal. But and if they had teams out there who could absorb his salary. Blake Griffin is not, like, I don't think the Clippers are there yet. And I think one of the reasons they wanted to sign him this summer was to have a superstar who would keep them relevant in LA regardless. But again, like, we might get a year down the road and it's just, it'll be clear that things are not going to work out with the Clippers and he's an asset.
Don't you think the Grizzlies fans would push back on what you said, though? I mean, I think it's one of those things where outside we say this team has no ceiling. Inside they say we just want to be in the playoffs and have a fun show, you know, and Conley's been delivering that year after year. They started hot.
Are they going to be in the playoffs this year?
They got a chance. I mean, they started hot. He missed some time here recently, so they've lost a couple, but they're in the mix. I mean, they're relevant locally in a market that doesn't really have anything else. I mean, that's sort of their standard, right? It's kind of like the Oklahoma City thing we've mentioned with Westbrook before, where they're almost playing by a different set of rules in terms of what qualifies as success for their own franchises. Yeah. And that'd be one reason why I could see them riding him a little bit longer than other teams might.
Do you think Minnesota would ever trade Wiggins?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, look, they had to pull the money out of the owner's hands during that contract negotiation. Man, that thing went on for 3 months. Glenn Taylor's like setting all these accountability rules for Wiggins. You know, he's got to do this, this, and the other thing. And as we've mentioned, it's not like Wiggins has really grown his game so far this year. He's the same guy. But I don't think they're in a huge rush.
We didn't really talk about that. We didn't talk about that as it happened, but the Wiggins deal, there were a lot of people who said, like, well, they have no choice but to pay him $150 million. Like, that's just the way it is, and they're a small market, and they have to do that. I've talked to a couple people from other teams who have said, like, what the hell were the Wolves thinking? Like, he wasn't going to go out and get $150 million from another team around the NBA. So,
well, I think the concern for them was, and it's maybe not a great justification, but I think they were worried that, like, you make Wiggins go to restricted free agency, so you have this just awkward pall over the whole season, right? Wiggins and Butler are already fighting for touches. Wiggins pouts and mopes, and now all of a sudden you don't get over the hump and make the playoffs. I think that was really, you know, driving a lot of their urgency to get that deal done. And I mean, he came right out and told me in Las Vegas in the middle of the whole thing, he's like, I'm not going to take a penny less than the max, you know, basically kiss off. And so if you're the ownership, it's like, well, okay, now what, you know?
It was pretty bizarre the way everybody just went along with it and was like, yeah, of course, it's perfectly normal for Wiggins to get $30 million a year. All right, so between Russ, Blake, and Wall, who's most likely to be traded?
I would say
Blake.
Blake, yeah. I think some of it's positionally. I've been surprised that he hasn't been able to carry more and produce more victories, kind of put the team on his back so far this season. I don't know if that means I'm disappointed in him, but I've always been a Blake backer, probably to the point of annoying you over these last couple of years. But, you know, point blank, when your team's on a 9-game losing streak, you got to go out there and fix it. And Blake hasn't really been able to do that. You also look at the injury stuff, and I think, you know, you just look, he's improved as a three-point shooter, right? But he doesn't really have that knockdown three-point shot. He's not really a stretch four, so he's kind of a weird guy to build around. I think with Westbrook and Wall both, as long as they're relatively healthy, you can build solid teams around them, as long as they don't involve Carmelo Anthony, by the way. But I just think, like, those teams... And really, too, I think market matters here, too, right? Like, if you're Oklahoma City and you're Washington, I mean, those are guys who you have to pull them out of those markets, you know, kind of by their dead bodies.
Okay, well, it's just something I wanted to think about. And I'm glad it also allowed you to get in your standard mellow shot for the podcast. But we'll see where it goes with some of these guys, particularly the Clippers. Like, I don't think it's going to get any easier, like, 9 months from now. But moving on here, Khalid says, my question is, now that KP has solidified himself in New York as a generational talent, I do not trust Jeff Hornacek, and I look at him as an average coach at best. What do you guys need to see from Jeff Hornacek to convince you that he's actually a good coach? My dream situation for the past 3 years has been the Knicks hiring Becky Hammon to be our head coach. First of all, Khalid, it would be really cool for Becky Hammon to be a head coach somewhere. I would definitely not wish the Knicks hell on Becky Hammon and having to start out like shepherding Porzingis' career with the snake pit of Knicks media right there would be kind of miserable. But
let me just say,
question is a good one.
In Becky's defense, she would own them all. She would not.
You think so?
She would not blink at the New York media. She's great.
I don't know.
She won the Summer League title. I'm basing it all on her performance at Summer League, but she was awesome. She was great with the media, and you know, she's got the ring to show for it.
Sure, absolutely. But Hornacek, though, what do you think?
I think it's more fun actually to think back on the fact that Derek Fisher was the Knicks coach. You remember that? This guy's on Dancing with the Stars. I mean, he's flipping vehicles on the highway. We shouldn't joke about that, but he has had just an absolute mess since he was the Knicks coach, and that was Phil Jackson's big move. It's like, oh, Steve Kerr, Derek Fisher. Boy, I wonder which one he should have chosen there. It's,
you know, that could actually be part of why I'm skeptical about Becky Hammon, is because it's been like 20 years since we've seen a competent Knicks head coach in there who could actually handle people. So maybe you're right. Like, I'm used to Mike Woodson and Derek Fisher Fisher and then Phil to a degree. Like, we just, there has not been a lot of competent leadership up there.
I think my message to Khalid here is to just hold off slightly, like enjoy this moment. I think you were the one who was preaching Nick's optimism, you know, a podcast or two ago. They're still right. Technically in the playoff picture. Let's not fire the coach. I mean, I did not see this coming at all. Like, let's wait until, you know, and if it even happens that they slide out, you know, they're down there in 12th or 13th in the East before we start running him out of town.
Do you think the Knicks are going to actually make the playoffs? Because I really like Porzingis, but every time I see them, I watched Knicks Clippers Monday night. And every time I watch those guys play well, I'm shocked that it's happening. Like, I'm shocked that Doug McDermott is a real contributor for them. Courtney Lee is playing like 38 minutes a game for them. Cantor is pretty good. So I'm wondering how much of this is like an early season mirage and how much, like, whether they can actually keep it together.
No, I think the odds are they fall apart. So that's why I'm saying you don't have to rush in to fire the coach, Khalid. I know that's your okay. natural instinct.
So you're saying
his natural instinct as a Knicks fan is to just burn the whole thing down. Look, we get that, man, but there's going to be time for that right. down the road.
Yeah, your point is that you'll have plenty of February and March misery where you can just shit on Hornacek for the final 3 months of the season.
Yeah, and look, he didn't have to completely empower Porzingis, right? Like, let's give him credit for doing that. I mean, there's a lot of ways he could have approached it. You know, we should hold last year against him in terms of whatever influence Phil Jackson was able to have on the offense. I mean, that's a tough spot for a coach to be in when your boss is saying, hey, try to do this. And it comes at the expense of a guy like Porzingis, but the coach deserves some level of credit for the breakthrough. I mean, he's being put in situations where he's allowed to succeed, even if that situation is just give him the ball and let him go to work.
Yeah, I mean, there weren't that many other options as far as empowerment on the Knicks roster. But next question from Bobby. And we honestly got like 10 emails about this from various listeners, so we appreciate it. But Bobby says, I'm shocked at how little LeBron to Philly buzz there has been. Philly's young talent is head and shoulders above the Lakers. A LeBron, Simmons, and Embiid big three would dominate the Eastern Conference. It would also be really cool to see LeBron channel his inner Dr. J. What do you guys think? What do you think, Ben?
No, what do you think, Andrew? Because you've got a really good theory. I believe your theory revolves around LeBron's Instagram presence and Joel Embiid's Instagram presence, correct?
I mean, no, I just think that I really enjoy the Sixers as they are, and I would love to see them grow. We said the same thing about the Knicks 2 weeks ago, and watching the Sixers against the Warriors Saturday night, like, that was wild. They're not far off from being truly, truly scary. And LeBron adding his sort of overbearing persona and cryptic Instagram posts, it would just sort of ruin it for me. And I'm sure that there are plenty of people in Philadelphia who would be pumped to see it happen. And it would be one of the craziest sports stories. Like, LeBron joining the process would be insane. But I think that it would be a lot more fun to just watch them develop on their own.
So I was walking to the Playa yesterday, bumping the new Taylor Swift, and one Great. Of her line. Have you listened to it at all? Or
you know what? I heard the first two singles. I actually like Taylor Swift.
Nice,
but one out of every four albums of hers is just awful, and this seems like that one.
Well, we can keep it real. Reputation is not 1989. I think we can all agree on that. But there was one.
It's really, really not.
There was one line on the song Gorgeous where she says, you should think about the consequence of your magnetic field being a little too strong. And when I heard that line, of course, I thought of you and your LeBron James take here, overshadowing guys like Joel Embiid. His magnetic field might be too strong for these young guys, but maybe LeBron is smart enough to listen to Taylor's advice and dial it back a little bit. Maybe that's going to be part of the next LeBron iteration. We can only hope, because I need to update my take. I have said here for a while that LeBron and Kawhi would be the best 4-5 matchup to go against Durant. and Draymond, you know, in a theoretical final, I guess Western Conference Finals. I think that's wrong. I think if your front line is LeBron, Ben Simmons, and Joel Embiid, that is a matchup against any three frontline players from Golden State that you can win and starting next season. And so if we're saying strictly like basketball-wise, those three guys plus two shooters, that is absolutely a Warriors killing lineup. Of course, it depends on Embiid staying healthy. And also, I do think you're right to say it depends a little bit on sacrifice in terms of, you know, LeBron's shadow. But I don't think it's crazy. You know, if I was him and I was like sizing up all these situations by ability to win a title, Philly is rocketing up that list faster than any other spot.
So you don't think LeBron is redundant with Simmons a little bit? I mean, although LeBron has been shooting the hell out of the basketball the last like month or so. I don't know what his numbers are, but it seems like every game I watch, he's like 3 of 5 from three or 4 of 6. Like he's that's a part of his game that makes him completely unstoppable. So if that's real, then the Simmons point isn't an issue.
Well, hold on one second.
That fit doesn't worry you?
So when you go to Taco Bell and you order sometimes 3 or 4 of the double decker tacos, when you're looking at that third or fourth one, does it come to your mind that this is redundant? I've already eaten two, or are you like, yes, no, I've got two more?
It absolutely doesn't.
Okay, so that's what I'm saying. It's a good problem to have redundant, awesome playmakers. That is not called redundancy. That is called twice as nice. I think what would end up happening is Simmons would have to shift off the ball a little bit more, which that worries you because he's not a shooter. This guy's a really good cutter. I mean, he's good off the ball. He has really good basketball instincts. He would still be a scorer. And I think the plan would be you'd stagger minutes and you'd pull LeBron's regular season minute total down a little bit. And this is what I mean about him taking Taylor Swift's advice, because right now his magnetic field is still set to like 14 out of 10. Like he's welcoming, he's welcoming all of these minutes this year, right? Like he just wants to play like 40 plus minutes. He doesn't care. He says his body's fine. That's great. It's not the long-term approach I'd like to see LeBron take with his career right now. I think he needs to scale back a little bit, dial back, and Simmons could help him do that in much the same way like the Spurs system would be able to help him do that. But it doesn't really seem like he's interested in aging gracefully. But I do think that they could play together very well, and they'd just be a nightmare because they'd both be able to swing the ball from side to side with those crazy cross-court passes, and then whoever gets the pass would be able to attack the weak side of a defense. They would put together some insane highlight reels. And they would also be really, really tough in pick and roll situations. Either one of those guys being able to use Embiid as a screener, Embiid being a shooting threat in pick and pops. I mean, how do you even scheme for that? It's mind blowing.
Yeah, I would be thrilled if LeBron was willing to dial it back. I don't think he has that in him at this point, but I worry about him turning into like Brett Favre late in his career, or I mean Kobe was like this too, where it was just sort of like he soaks up so much oxygen that ultimately he's just sort of exhausting. I hope that's not where we're headed with LeBron. I do have two more quick takes on the Sixers. First of all, did you see Embiid with Donovan Mitchell Monday night?
Oh no, how could I possibly have missed that?
Yeah, there were probably 800 tweets about it, and his tweet over the weekend after the Warriors collapse, like, I don't know what it is about Embiid, but he's into Gronk territory with me now, where like his shtick and his whole act should be old, and like it's essentially sort of the same joke over and over again, and yet I crack up at every single thing he does, whether it's online or on the court. Like he is truly like a wrestling character, and I love him for it. And the second take is watching Warriors Sixers Saturday night. Early in that second half, the Sixers were up 20, and Embiid went crashing into the stanchion under the basket and was down on the floor like motionless for, I don't know, like 30 seconds. And I thought to myself, like, if Embiid had gone out and been out for the year and never really regained his, like, basically never played again, it would have been the craziest sports story of all time for him to go out like dominating the Warriors and then just we never heard from him again.
The fact that you have that take, it's got me a little worried about you, Andrew. I mean, that is a very, very twisted takeaway from what was an amazing game full of lots of runs. I don't know why your mind constantly goes towards Philly fan agony. I mean, I'm sure there's some...
No, but can you imagine it? Like, yeah. That would make for the greatest 30 for 30 of all time. Like, go through the past 5 years. I mean, it would be heartbreaking, obviously.
I'm not sure we should call it the greatest if a guy's career is getting ruined here. Come on. Dial it back a little bit. You're being way more heartless. That's my job. You know, there's this whole good cop, bad cop. You're supposed to be the good cop. Two things about the Embiid.
I'm glad that he came back to play.
Yeah, me too. Two things about the Embiid situation. First of all, where was the retroactive flop warning from the NBA? I mean, do we have a flop policy or do we not have a flop policy? He basically admitted that he flopped with Donovan Mitchell. Let's enforce this. I hate to be the only guy who cares about rules, the only stickler in this world, but he definitely flopped in that thing. Let's warn him and let's get a fine ready if he does it again. Second thing, you were mentioning like his jokes and how you're back in and he's funny. I will admit that I didn't think he was funny at all when he wasn't playing, but now that he's actually playing and it's not just these like theoretical jokes, there's like this osmosis or there's almost like a membrane between social media and reality because he's actually on the court and like the jokes are going back and forth between the membrane.
Right.
Now I'm in. Now I actually think he's kind of funny. So it took me years and years to come around to this. I'm the last one on the Embiid might be a funny person bandwagon, but I'm there.
That's how you know the Sixers have succeeded. Ben Golliver, who hates all things that are fun, has found a way to enjoy Joel Embiid. So congrats, Philly, and I hope LeBron doesn't go there to ruin it. Next question will be from Daniel, who says, news has just broken that Michael Porter Jr. is set to undergo season-ending surgery. How much do you think this affects his draft stock? I personally have him dropping to fifth behind Luka Doncic, Marvin Bagley, DeAndre Ayton, and Mo Bamba, but he would be an incredible steal at five if he can return to 100%. Ben, you probably have no idea who Michael Porter Jr. is.
Well,
is that right?
Completely wrong. Thanks again for not reading what I write. I did a whole roundtable answer about how I like Michael Porter Jr. and how I think sometimes polished players kind of get overlooked in this most intriguing, most fascinating, upside-obsessed world of you draft Knicks. By the way, I like that this emailer has got his own big board in November. Congratulations. I'm glad he's got him dropping to five. Okay, cool. From what everyone said, as long as he comes back healthy and he's able to go through the pre-draft process, seems like he's still going to be a top five guy. That would be my assumption.
Well, first of all, I do remember reading your Michael Porter Jr. blurb, and I loved it because the scout that I talked to about Michael Porter Jr., I have never seen him play, but a scout was describing his game to me, and he sounded like exactly the type of player that you hate. Just like inefficient scorer, doesn't do enough beyond shooting and doesn't really like defensively, the effort's not there, but he does have a ton of upside. It's to me, the draft, again, this is really, really early, but it seems like a five player draft and Porter will be somewhere between three and five. Although season-ending surgery, there's something to do with his spine. Obviously, that's pretty concerning, but we have no idea. I'm just glad that you're in on basically 6'10 DeRozan.
I would not call him that. I think one reason why I like him is the positional versatility. He can play both four positions. He can go out there in space. I think he's going to be all right. I hate when guys get compared to Kevin Durant. That drives me nuts. I don't know. I watched some tape on him. I saw him at the Hoop Summit. Like, I do not see the KD stuff at all. I don't know where that came from. So it did seem like the scouts had cooled on Porter already before the injury. Like, at some points he was kind of viewed as like the number one guy, but now he's already down to like four or five. So I would guess that's where he lands. Also, if you're one of these teams that likes to game the lottery system and wants to pull a process, like, wouldn't it be smart to just take him, redshirt him, like his rookie year, you know, just kind of pull a modified Ben Simmons or Markelle Fultz here. and just tank again and then come back the next year. Like, I could see a really forward-thinking team doing that.
This is another sign of Sixers' success. We've got Ben Golliver lobbying for redshirt rookies.
Okay. Well, now you're again extrapolating from what I'm saying. I just think that there could be, you know, someone like Big Head Gar Foreman. Like, wouldn't that be a good move? If you don't get one of the top three picks, take him, and then just say you're taking his recovery very slow. You're having the utmost caution, just to ensure that you have another losing season afterwards. I could see it.
Absolutely. Moving on to another team that we have ignored for the better part of the last month. D. Fred says, man, I get you don't like the Raptors, but why do you and Ben insist on never bringing them up? And then we have a second emailer who says, Dave says, I love the pod, but I've felt slighted ever since hearing the shade you both threw on my hometown Toronto Raptors this preseason, and your basic refusal to acknowledge our existence since. While the Raptors are obviously not the Spurs, I do think the comparison is appropriate. A very good team that just goes out and wins every year. While we may not have sexy superstars that dominate the SportsCenter top 10, 50 wins is the norm around here now. We've developed a ton of unheralded prospects into legit rotation players. OG Anunoby, Pascal Siakam, Jakob Poeltl, DeLon Wright, and Norman Powell, and even little Fred Van Vliet have all been great. We play 10 to 12 deep every game, which sounds crazy, but all of them have earned their minutes and contribute. A great problem to have. Raptors equal Spurs. Ben, your response, please.
Okay, I'm going to try to be polite because my first instinct was to see red, okay? First of all, I want to say that I can really see where D. Fred and Dave are coming from. As someone who was born and raised in Portland, that chip on your shoulder, everybody overlooks us over versus them thing is totally ingrained. I get what the Raptors fans are saying. And actually, I believe Dave pointed out that we snubbed the Raptors fans in our conversation about the best buildings in the NBA. We absolutely did snub the Raptors fans. You know, the whole Jurassic Park thing outside the game, outside the building during playoffs, and just how loud they get. I mean, that's a legit home court advantage. There's no question about it. I'm going to make an admission here. I can't remember if I've admitted this before. Andrew, I'm a quarter Canadian. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you know that. I really am. Yeah. No, and it's funny because the grandfather who, you know, took me into the handicap bathroom, cutting the line, he's the Canadian. So I don't know if that's just common practice up there or what. But he lived in America for most of his life, born in Canada. The reason why I bring this up is because I believe that gives me license to speak Canadian to Canadian here. And guys, I know you want a seat at the table. I know you guys want us to show you the respect, but everything you just outlined, Dave, sounds to me like you're describing a regular season team. We go deep. We're fun to watch. We play hard. We play together. All that stuff. As if we just didn't see you guys completely collapse against the Cavaliers in last year's playoffs. The line that really set me off, though, Andrew, it really bothered me, was the comparison to the Spurs and how he was saying 50 wins is the norm, he says. Okay, do you know how many times in the entire history of the Toronto Raptors that they've won 50 games in a season, Andrew? Do you know how many?
Twice probably, the last 2 years, right?
Bingo. Trivia answer correct. Ding, ding, ding. Two times the last two seasons. They might get it a third time this year. Do you know how many times the San Antonio Spurs have won 50 games in their franchise's history?
I will guess they've done it for what, the last like 18 years?
Yeah, I believe minus one of the lockout seasons potentially. They have done it 27 times, okay? So 27 to 2. And then it's not even the postseason where San Antonio has racked up wins, racked up Hall of Famers. They have this kind of history. So I hate to break it to you, Dave, the Spurs are the Spurs of Texas. They're the Spurs of the United States. They're the Spurs of Canada. They are the Spurs of the world. There is only one Spurs. The Raptors are not Canada Spurs. They don't belong in the same sentence. They've never done anything of consequence in the postseason besides embarrass themselves. And by the way, we actually have brought them up this season because DeRozan bricked two potential game winners against the Celtics when we were sort of hoping that they would beat Boston and snap their streak. So guys, Canadian to Canadian here, please just relax. Toronto is not in this conversation. You know what it actually reminds me of, Andrew? What's that book? It's got a lot of chapters and verses. It's got all these commandments, these rules about how you're living your life. That's right. It's called the Bible. You do not have false idols. You worship only the Spurs gods. You do not try to put the Raptors on their level. Okay, I'm done. That's it.
I love it. I love it. Dave, don't compare anyone to the Spurs. That's the surest way to get Golliver all worked up. I was impressed. I knew you were going to come hard on that question. And D. Fred, I don't personally have a problem with the Raptors. And we get a lot of emailers talking to me specifically about my biases. I will say the only team in the NBA that I legitimately don't like, and we're not going to get into it right now, but the only team that I truly don't enjoy is the Houston Rockets. I just don't give a shit about them at all. The Raptors, I have a problem sort of caring at this point because, like you said, like we've seen this story so many different times. I like all the guys on that bench. Fred VanVleet is someone that I wanted like 10 different teams to take a chance on in the second round. Couple years ago, it was clear that he was going to be a helpful guard off the bench, and OG Anunoby is exciting, but like it doesn't change the baseline with the Raptors. They'll have to change it in the playoffs. But I do love Canada. Canada is where we met, man. That's like Toronto All-Star Weekend is where this podcast was born.
That took a really emotional turn. I appreciate you remembering that. That's fantastic. I had forgotten. My bad. I would also say, I told you about the baby raps coming into the season. We were discussing the most entertaining teams to watch, and I said, hey, check out their bench. This could be interesting. A lot of new blood there. Pascal's a lot of fun. OG, I'm surprised you haven't tried to drastically overrate OG and you're continuing hype of
good,
all these rookies.
Man.
Yeah. And everybody else is solid. I mean, I respect them because Masai looked in the mirror and said, our way wasn't working. We've got to, you know, try to modernize our offense, change our shot selection. And he really took it seriously. We were yelling about that for years and they did it. So let's give them full credit for that. But when you're trying to, you know, play catch up and you've got these other teams out there, Houston, Golden State, I mean, these real contenders who have already been doing it for years, you can't expect us to put your favorite team on that level. Sorry.
Do you remember when we were first discussing the podcast?
Well, I just remember you asked me if I was willing to be a guest. I did one podcast and then somehow I became the co-host the next week. I didn't know how that happened. I don't know how you bamboozled me into this, but I do remember that.
It was great. It was great. I was a little worried. I knew I wanted to host it with you because Matt Dollinger, our editor, said that you were funnier than people realized and that we would be like a good pair. But then I met you like before the All-Star game, and you had like three Red Bulls next to you and you were working on something, and you basically gave me like 15 seconds of your attention, and then you were like, I actually got to work. And so I walked away. I was like, we'll see. And then I remember you stayed like an extra 5 days in Canada and just hung out and did sightseeing around Toronto. So it was an early glimpse into the life and times of Ben Golliver.
Well,
for me.
Don't take it personally. I like to think that you've loosened me up a little bit, Andrew. I like to think that maybe, you know, you've got me to not be quite as psycho as I was then. And also, by the way, I have kicked the Red Bull habit, so let's give me credit for that, too.
It's true. It's true. There's been a lot of growth from both of us over the last 2 years or so. I'm proud of us. Moving on, though, Pete in England says, I enjoy the talk about renaming/debating unicorns. A word I thought could work is one used in football/soccer for decades. Libero, which is the Italian word for free. It relates to great players who operate out of defense, but push forward and act as a playmaker. It's associated with all-time greats and World Cup legends such as Germany's Franz Beckenbauer, England's own Bobby Moore, and in the modern era with Spain's serial winner Sergio Ramos. Given its esteem in football and unicorns like Giannis, Porzingis, and Jokic originating from Europe, I thought libero would be suitable. Pete, this was an awesome email, and I love the idea for libero. I think we'll probably stick with unicorn because we've already come pretty far with unicorn, but libero works too. Basically, all I ask is that we make this more official, whether it's libero or unicorn. It really matters to me that at some point over the next 10 years or so, it becomes an official position that's like listed on rosters, so that even like certain teams just won't have a libero or a unicorn, and you'll see like you and I where PG and center is. You'll see UNI or LIB, and it'll just be empty, and then fans can say, man, we got to get a unicorn, or we got to get a libero. That's what I want.
I want to echo what you said. This was an amazing email, Pete. You really got me excited, mostly because when I was a kid, one of my original screen names was Beckenbauer, similar to Beckenbauer, you know. little play on words there, but what I like about libero better than unicorn is unicorn does have a little bit of the freak side to it. It's like, oh, he's the unicorn. He's different. He's weird. Whereas libero, it more describes like the visual element of what you might see during the game, right? Like here is this guy who's just like effortlessly moving from defense to offense outside the bounds or like the normal strictures of gameplay. And that really describes especially what a guy like Giannis does. So that was my one question. I mean, it's almost like I feel like this term would apply more for guys like Giannis and Simmons and LeBron as opposed to the bigs, because we're not seeing like Porzingis like necessarily like leading a fast break or Embiid really like leading a fast break consistently. So maybe there's a way where we can split the unicorn designation between like real ball handlers and the other guys and leave the other guys as unicorns. But I love libero. I might try to just test drive it out here on some subsequent podcasts. We'll see.
Yeah. Yeah, I like it. I like the idea of free because you're right. The unicorn, I don't like the freakish element of it. It really is more of a freedom and a blurring of positional boundaries. So shout out to Pete. Brett says, I don't have a question. I have a plea. On this week's episode, please do not discuss LaVar Ball. You're in luck, Brett, because I really don't care about LaVar Ball. Do you like, I'm not one of the sanctimonious people who's like, oh, we need to stop giving this guy attention. But I'm also not like a LaVar Ball stan who looks at him as some sort of revolutionary. I just like truly can't bring myself to care one way or the other.
Well, unfortunately for Brett, he sent this email in, I believe, in response to the back and forth with Trump, and I was just going to leave that alone. But LaVar actually crossed to me what is the red line last night.
What?
Because he made comments about how Luke Walton is coaching his son, and he said Luke's kind of babying Lonzo, he needs to be tougher, and that LaVar knows how to coach Lonzo, and that basically the Lakers don't. To me, that was the red line always, where we have to give him oxygen and discussion time because that affects basketball environment. That affects the locker room. That affects the team. And if he continues to ramp that up, especially if Lonzo struggles, if he's blaming Lonzo's struggles as a public figure and as the father of Lonzo, if he's blaming that stuff on the coaching staff or on the organization, that is 100% a story, and we have to talk about it.
That's true. We're not going to talk about it right now because it's almost Thanksgiving and I just don't care. But I will say I'm shocked that we've come this far without LaVar Ball taking shots at Luke Walton. I mean, like, I would have guessed
12 games,
2 weeks. Yeah. Like, it's congratulations, LaVar Ball, for making it almost to Thanksgiving without taking a shot at Luke Walton. But moving on. Peter sent us a really long email with a couple different takes I liked. First, if Spencer Dinwiddie had been drafted at 18 instead of Tyler Ennis, would he be considered more valuable today? This was after Peter is a Nets fan, and this was a long after like a long digression on the value of Spencer Dinwiddie. I don't think Spencer Dinwiddie is going to be considered valuable in any context, but it is a good reminder that Tyler Ennis was drafted at 18 after the Suns had just signed three point guards. It's another greatest hit in Ryan McDonough's long tenure that we often forget about.
Yeah, Ennis is probably somewhere being like, look, why am I not making the list of the 10 biggest mistakes of the Ryan McDonough era? This is crazy. I'm only honorable exactly. mention. Give me my love. The thing I would say, it's a good point. I mean, we mentioned it earlier with Wiggins, right? How much of the reason why his negotiation starts at max or nothing is because he was a number one pick? I would say the same thing applies for Anthony Bennett. How many chances did that guy get? You know, I mean, how many does he get if he's like a 10th or 15th pick who, you know, clearly doesn't care about basketball and really has no discernible skills? It seems like he got about six second chances. So I absolutely think that the psychological effect of a guy going higher gives benefits for him throughout his career. There's no question.
Totally. It's the difference between Otto Porter signing for $130 million and Robert Covington signing for $62 million. Like, it's Covington is, I mean, I'm happy for him that he got paid, but I cannot believe his agent let him sign that deal.
Yeah, no, that it's a silly number. There's no doubt about it. Oh, and by the way,
ridiculous.
And that's terrible of me because I snubbed him earlier when we were talking about LeBron with the Sixers. If you want to roll out LeBron, yeah. Ben Simmons, Covington, Embiid, and one shooter, good luck, Golden State. I will take that Sixers lineup. If everybody's healthy and they get it all together, they get their chemistry and so forth, that's just so much size, so much playmaking, so much length, defensive ferocity. I love it.
It would be unreal. All right, second take from Peter. 10-time looks legit. 10-time is what we nicknamed Jason Tatum this summer after Celtics, I guess it was Celtics media, was walking around Vegas Summer League predicting that he was going to be a 10-time All-Star. And the answer, Peter, is he absolutely looks legit. And it's been a while since I've been this wrong on a draft prospect, but I am absolutely this wrong on Jason Tatum, in part because I did not see him shooting 45 or 50% from three. But Tatum and Simmons are two guys that I have completely missed on.
Yeah, it hadn't been that long. It'd been 1 year. But I'm messing with you. I'm sorry. I couldn't help myself. I really couldn't. His numbers are going to come back, don't you think? I mean, I think he has started so well. It does seem a little bit to me like his shooting might be unsustainable. I think he gets every benefit in Boston in terms of how they're set up. But 82-game schedule is a long schedule for young guys. The first time they go through it, every rookie to a man, you know, says they weren't ready for it by February and March. So I would say he has been awesome, definitely better than he looked in summer league. There's no question about it. He benefits from, playing with Boston's, star players. There's no doubt about it. But I would be selling his stock at this point.
Actually, yeah, you're right. I don't want to go overboard on my contrition, with Tatum. Like he is good. I don't think he's going to be a 10-time All-Star. Let's put it that way. But, the last one was French Frank is an extremely valuable system player. The Knicks-Nets game and arguably the Knicks season changed when he entered. He plays basketball the right way and moves the ball effectively and with purpose. If LeBron would take Dennis Smith over Ntilikina, he does not understand team construction. Now, that might not be wrong because it's true that French Frank, his numbers are not great, but he's actually doing a pretty good job with the Knicks. And LeBron, like, automatically saying they should have taken Dennis Smith over him does kind of speak to why he's been such a bad GM over the last 10 years.
I don't know if it does, because I'm not sure he actually cares one way or the other. I think he was solely looking for a way to jab Phil Jackson, you know, and I think that is a good example of how you can be a bad GM, is to let it get personal with other GMs and make moves based on that. And most good GMs, you know, strip the emotions out of it and try not to be petty. But yeah, if LeBron was making moves because it's the opposite of what Phil Jackson did, that's sort of like what our current president is doing with regards to Obama. And that's
that's true.
It's generally not the necessarily the right way to do it. I mean, if LeBron continues to say that every player drafted after Neil Aquino would have been a better option for the Knicks, then he'll just come right out and it'll be obvious what he's trying to do. But I thought that was so thinly veiled shots at Phil Jackson that he basically just admitted it the next day, right?
Oh yeah, he did admit it, but the Dennis Smith thing, like, I think Dennis Smith has the type of game that players around the league are gonna love him, and I don't know if he's actually that much better than Neil Aquino. If Neil Aquino's shooting can progress over the next two or three years, he is gonna be a really useful piece. He's not gonna be as fun as Dennis Smith, but as a partner with Porzingis, I'm bullish on French Frank, which I'm shocked by.
Well, that's good. That's one more reason for Knicks fans to be excited and to not fire the coach quite yet.
All right, let's wrap this up. A couple questions for the podium. A. Litch says, I've never missed an episode of Open Floor. Andrew Sharp is my favorite writer, and in spite of their endless reminders, I only just now gave my 5-star review. I held out in solidarity until I got to see the Ben Golliver magnet collection. #5stars. First of all, thank you, A. Litch. I appreciate you reading. And second of all, thank you for holding out. We were all waiting for the Golliver magnet collection, and it really did not disappoint. I'm proud of Ben for finally coming through. And I'm proud of our next emailer for also driving Ben insane. Sam says, you guys made November 17th an absolute highlight for me. I was the one who ruined Golliver's little Instagram moment by unfollowing him and following Sharp right at the moment he posted the magnets. I got called out on the pod, and that made me king for a day in our little nerdy NBA WhatsApp chat group that consists of 7 middle-aged white guys and me.
Okay.
What do you think?
Well, many thoughts here. First, though, most importantly, when I told the story and I told you that someone had unfollowed me immediately and followed you, did you think I had lost my mind, or did you think that it had really happened?
I did. I thought it was like an Instagram glitch, and I had no idea what you were talking about.
Good. Complete validation, because I'm sure you were not alone. I think, and I noticed my follower count swell. Open Floor Globe really came through for me, Andrew. I probably added 150 followers after this whole story that I told on last week's episode, and I guarantee you at least half of them were complete pity follows. They were like, this guy's life is in shambles. He's falling apart. He's going crazy. There's no possible way that this thing actually happened. But I knew it had. I absolutely was convinced it had. I was so glad that Sam copped to being the devil who I called out on last week's episode. I think it's awesome that A. Litch called you his favorite writer. You're doing a great job. I do have a bone to pick, though, because when I was gone and you did that episode with Jeremy Wu, I believe you said that you read Jeremy more than every other Sports Illustrated writer. And when I listened to that, and the worst part of it was, you sent me a text message. Hey, did you listen to my podcast with Wu? So I'm getting all excited. 10 minutes in, I get blindsided with this fact that I'm not your favorite SI writer, Andrew. It's crazy, man. It's just really, really, really sad.
You know what, man? I read your big projects. Your Nurkic story this week was fantastic. I loved it.
Here we go.
It reminded me why I love Yusuf Nurkic as much as I have. I've been on Team Nurkic from the beginning, and you reminded me why. So shout out to you. I do read your big stories. But I also, I get enough NBA takes. Like, sometimes people ask me, like, who's your favorite NBA writer to read? And quite frankly, talking to you about basketball for like 2.5 to 3 hours every week is most of what I need from the NBA blogosphere. So I really only pick like Wu is writing about shit that we don't talk about. So I'll always read Wu. But for everything else, I just rely on you as my font of wisdom.
I read every word that you write, and I hope you think about that over the holiday weekend.
All right. Well, speaking of the holiday here, we have a Thanksgiving-themed question. Brady says, With Thanksgiving coming up, I was just thinking, Thanksgiving is like the all-star break. No school, get off of work, and you get a great lineup of food. If you guys had to pick your five all-star courses for Thanksgiving, what would they be and which basketball position would they play? Now, Ben, I was really excited about this question, but I'm going to let you go first.
No, I think you should go first because we had a lot of people coming to me and kind of mockingly asking me this question like, oh, what does a vegetarian eat for Thanksgiving? Ha, 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 you know, playing that whole thing. And I've got responses, but I want to hear your lineup first.
Okay, so here is my response. I was very excited about this question, but I also misunderstood the question. So I took notes on this when you sent it over last night. And then just before we went on to do the podcast, I realized that I read the question wrong. So what I was doing was comparing basketball players to Thanksgiving dishes. And I will give you my lineup here. What I did was compare the Golden State Warriors to
this is way
Thanksgiving
better.
Courses.
This is awesome. Go for it.
All right, so Steph Curry is the turkey because turkey makes the entire Thanksgiving meal. And there are some shitheads out there who will tell you that turkey is overrated and you don't need turkey. And like the real enlightened person is eating like duck or turducken or whatever. No, turkey is crucial to every Thanksgiving. And likewise, Draymond Green is mashed potatoes and gravy. Because he is not totally healthy for you, but just as crucial as the turkey to a successful Thanksgiving. Klay Thompson is pecan pie. Not crucial to the meal itself, but absolutely delightful and consistent and pretty underrated, actually. And then Kevin Durant, so... Every year,
careful here, because you're known Kevin Durant hater. If you're going to throw him out there with some crazy thing that nobody eats, like asparagus or something like that, I'm going to have a problem.
I'm not. So every year, my family also gets a ham for Thanksgiving, and ham is good. I'll eat ham like 364 days a year. I have no problem with ham. But on Thanksgiving, I always look at this giant ham that my dad gets, and I'm like, I don't know why we need it here. We would be just fine with the turkey and the potatoes and the gravy. So Kevin Durant is the ham. It's fine to like the ham, but we would be fine without it. Zaza is the cranberry sauce because... Zaza, it's just kind of there. No one is interested in the cranberry sauce.
Just buying time for the better stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Iguodala is sweet potatoes. Really, really good. However, let's not go overboard. Sweet potatoes, I often see ranked near the top of Thanksgiving course rankings. And sweet potatoes are good, but we don't have to get crazy. And then Swaggy P is stuffing. Because Swaggy P is delightful, and then like a day or two after Thanksgiving, I'll be eating leftovers, and like the stuffing just gets disgusting after a while, and so that's Swaggy P to me.
Yeah, you drastically underrated stuffing. Some people might call it dressing. That's my starting point guard. I'm building my whole show around dressing. I mean, you have to when you can't eat the meat, and no, I don't play around. With tofurkey or any of that nonsense. I just pretend that part doesn't exist. By the way, I agree on your turkey take. The tryptophan haters are a little too loud. Like, why do we always focus so much on tryptophan? Oh, it's going to knock you out. You're going to be sleeping for 3 days. Like, yeah, there's all sorts of bad stuff and all sorts of the foods that people eat. We really have focused as a society on tryptophan.
It's a crucial part of the experience. Like, you need to just eat too much turkey and then pass out. So the haters, take it down a notch.
Okay, stuffing and dressing's my point guard. I'm building the whole show around that. At the two-guard spot, I've got mashed potatoes and gravy. I just like how they can interplay. You can throw those together. You can, you know, kind of put them to... Just mix them all up. That's going to work out great. Small forward, I'm thinking here kind of like the Otto Porter role. I'm not really thinking a LeBron James style. I like rolls, just the bread rolls. You know, I'm all about that. Load up on as many different types as you can. If it's cornbread, that's fine, but rolls are great. At power forward, I'm stretching out with corn on the cob. I think that just kind of goes back to my childhood. Grandparents used to love corn on the cob. You know, I actually put peanut butter on corn on the cob when I was a kid too, sort of like I do with the tacos. Probably shouldn't have mentioned that. And then,
yeah, that's disgusting.
I know, whatever. And then last but not least, my center, who I really don't want to rely on as much as I do. I want to play more small ball, but I really can't help myself. It's mac and cheese, man. That's, you got to have mac and cheese. So that's my center. That's my five-man lineup. I think you won this one. Your Warriors comps were pretty solid.
Yeah, well, I didn't have a mac and cheese comp for the Warriors. And also, my family doesn't make mac and cheese, which is really frustrating. And it's been, I've been going without mac and cheese at Thanksgiving for the last 25 years. And it's a true hardship for me. But I liked your lineup as well. And I think that that's probably a good place to cut it. You know, we have another podcast that we're going to record today, and then we are going to drop it on Friday morning for people. And there's another one of the best / weirdest emails that we've gotten in a long time. And we're revisiting the top 100 on Friday's podcast as well. I've been waiting to do this for the past 3 weeks, and we're gonna get back into it and make some adjustments.
That sounded an awful lot like a great teaser, Andrew. Way to close this out strong. Yeah. Let's go ahead and talk 100 soon. But hey, for right now, follow us both on Instagram, Ben.Golliver. Andrew, I forget your handle. You know, we don't really necessarily need to mention that. Hopefully, I can widen my lead over you. That'll be great. I have also noticed, by the way, we've got Team Sharp and Team Golliver fan bases on Instagram who are dueling with each other. It's getting wild out there, sort of like the Civil War. 5-star reviews on iTunes, please, guys. We're over 500. We're aiming for 10,000 by Christmas. Help us out there. And Andrew, until later, I'll talk to you.
Everybody have a good Thanksgiving. We'll be back Friday.
Another great edition of Open Floor is in the books. Did you know Locked On has a daily podcast for all 30 NBA teams? If you're a Lakers fan, search Locked On Lakers. A Celtics fan, search Locked On Celtics. Warriors fans, search Locked On Warriors. Yes, all 30 NBA teams have a daily bite-sized podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team.
It's the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.